We are becoming angrier. We're more hateful. And as a result, there are more hate crime victims and more perpetrators. Between 2012 and 2023, hate crimes in England and Wales rose by an astonishing 252%, according to Home Office research. Professor Neil Chakraborty and Professor Matthew Williams are here to discuss the impact of hate crimes on the victims, their communities and wider British society, and what can be done to lower the incidence of hate crime. Professor Chakraborty has been studying this impact for the last two decades, working to understand hate crime victims, the people who attack them and why, and criminal justice policy, and is the director of the Centre for Hate Studies and the director of the Institute for Policy at the University of Leicester. Professor Matthew Williams is a professor of criminology in the School of Social Sciences at Cardiff University and leads the Hate Lab there, a global hub for data and insight into hate speech and crime. He's the author of the popular science book, The Science of Hate, which is published by Faber and Faber in 2021 and has studied the impact and root causes of online hate in particular. Welcome to both of you. When we invited you to come onto the We Society, Neil, I'll begin with you. What was your first thought when you heard this phrase, We Society? Perplexed, interested, engaged, or had you preconceived ideas?
I very much like the idea of the We Society. I like the series. I've enjoyed many of the episodes, but I think, well, it's the underlying theme of the We Society, the idea itself that captures my imagination. I like the idea that it draws our attention to the importance of the collective and not just the individual when we're seeking to develop meaningful, lasting, evidence-based answers to urgent questions that surround us. So, yeah, I like the idea. It was an honour to be part of this conversation.
Matthew?
A very much needed podcast, I think, in these troubling times. Certainly this year, we seem to be in very uncertain times, and that seems to be communicated very frequently in the media. And I think it creates a lot of anxiety amongst citizens. And I think a podcast of this nature is required to try and dig into some of these issues in a way that's scientifically informed. So I'm very excited to be here. Thank you.
I'm basking in it, or the whole team are basking in that. Thank you very much, both of you. I mean, how did you end up specialising in hate crime research? Neil, you go first.
In some ways, I think my career as a criminologist was a happy accident. I stumbled into it. I had a 2-week contract as a researcher, Will. I was researching offenders and shoplifters in particular, and spending time with shoplifters. And that turned into a 2-month project working with burglars. And it was absolutely fascinating. And then the years passed in a very happy way. And yet there was something nagging at me, and I felt quite unfulfilled, I think, as a researcher. And I think it was my own personal experiences that were born out through childhood and continued through adult life. And as an academic, it made me want to delve into those a bit more. It was my own experiences of hate and working with people who'd encountered hate in different forms and been frustrated by the responses to that hate. So I think all of this was born initially, if I'm honest, from personal curiosity. And then I was fortunate enough to develop a career based on that through research grants, through building things up, through working with victims, working with offenders, working with criminal justice agencies and other stakeholders. And things grew from there, Will. I'd like to say that there wasn't any need for this work, but I feel the demand for this work has become all the more urgent, particularly over this past decade.
Matthew, is there a similar trigger for you? And just give me a sense of why, in your view, this issue has become so much more salient, why there are so many incidences of hate crime over the last few years.
In terms of how I got into this, it was through a personal experience. Probably about 25 years ago, I was a victim of a homophobic hate crime in London, just after I finished my degree in sociology at Cardiff University. And I'd been planning to go into journalism, actually. I was going to do an MA in journalism at Cardiff Uni. Between my degree in sociology and that master's, I was attacked walking out of a gay bar. I was set upon by 3 men who attacked me. I fell to the floor. I had a split lip, could taste the blood in my mouth. And it was when they spat out a homophobic slur that I realized what had happened to me. And during that time, it was late 90s, there wasn't legislation in place that protected gay people from hate crime. That came a bit later. And that really kind of played on my mind. In fact, it played on my mind so much that I couldn't think of much else for quite some time. And it really changed my professional career as well as my personal life. And it was around then that I decided I needed to study this topic to and get the answers to those questions that I had in my mind, but why I was targeted that day. So again, very personal, like Neil's experience. And that's when I decided to study criminology. I thought that was the place to find out the answers. And that kind of leads on to your other question there, Will, which is ultimately, you know, why is it becoming so divisive? It seems like it's becoming very divisive. And I'm often asked the question, is it more hateful now than ever before? Which is obviously a really tricky question, because you immediately think about World War II and you know, genocide, anti-Semitism, and so on and so forth. But for me, the thing that's materially changed in the last decade or so is the availability of digital communications and the ubiquity of those communications and how they're not that regulated. And so instead of hate being something we may experience on public transport or when we're walking to school, it's now become a 24/7 phenomenon. People find it really difficult to escape hatred. And that's something that we found out when we conducted a study in Wales in 2011, which is kind of the early days of social media. We didn't really ask questions about social media in that survey, but victims were coming to us saying, well, actually, I'm more victimized online than I am offline. And that's having a bigger impact on my life than the stuff that I experience in the physical world. It's the online stuff that's insidious. It's all pervasive. And that's when we started to pivot our research agenda to understand how hate was being re-engineered, in a sense, to operate online.
What's driving this and what are the consequences? Just in headlines, and then we'll delve deeper.
Well, in terms of the online hatred that we're seeing, I think it's partly due to the technology. There are what we call engagement algorithms that are, if you like, running wild on many platforms, including X, which was formerly Twitter, but also YouTube, TikTok, etc. These algorithms are designed to pick up on what interests human beings, users on the platform. And the whole aim of those algorithms is to keep you engaged for as long as possible. They call them login sessions. And the more login sessions you have and the longer those login sessions last, the more money they can make from you via advertising or advertising at you. So that's the be-all and end-all, the economic model for these platforms. So engagement algorithms use something called deep learning, which is a form of machine learning to figure out ultimately what we're watching and what keeps us engaged. And what they figured out was that hate and extreme content is really very, very sticky. It keeps us watching for longer than, say, other types of content. Now, these algorithms have learned this over time. We are predisposed to look out for threat. It's a part of our human evolution in that sense. And we are attracted to bad news. We're attracted to hate on social media. And we remain engaged. And the algorithms pick this up and they start promoting it to you. So we get these sort of extremist rabbit holes that we can end up going down if we start to watch any kind of polarizing or hate-related content. Now, of course, social media companies have a choice. They could turn those off. They could turn them off, but they will lose a lot of money if they did so. And in fact, conversations that have been had with colleagues of mine, both in the UK and the US, quite frank conversations with CEOs of some of these companies have revealed that, you know, they have turned them off experimentally in the past and have found that they lose money if they do so. So there's no incentive for them to turn it off. Of course, we're also seeing social media weaponized by individuals and groups who have something to make out of polarization and extremity and extremism. And we see that happening at the individual level, but also at the political level. We're seeing it in the States right now. We saw it in the UK around Brexit and after that. But we're also seeing it at the state level. So foreign state interference, Russia, China, trying to destabilize democracies by increasing division within countries. So we've got the technology exacerbating this issue, but we also then have some level of human agency where there are individuals, groups, states trying to influence the kind of content that people see.
Now, Neil, I mean, I'm guessing you'd agree with much of that, but give me your sense of the consequences on the victims and more widely.
I do agree with much of what Matt's just said, and I found myself nodding in agreement with pretty much all of it. There's probably just one distinction I would make, and when Matt was saying that so many of the participants in his studies had felt and spoken very powerfully about the influence of social media and online hate, that comes through in our work, but not all the time. And I think sometimes it depends on the kinds of audiences that you're working with. So within many of my studies, particularly over the last 10 years, we've worked with particularly disadvantaged and disconnected communities, and many people within those communities are digitally disconnected. They suffer from a sense of digital poverty where that online world is less of an issue for them. It's actually a big problem because it means they can't connect to the support services that they need, because a lot of those are available only online and those support services have been hemorrhaged anyway. So being digitally disconnected has enormous disadvantages in all sorts of ways. But in terms of the experiences of hateful behaviours and actions, their experiences tend primarily to be offline. They tend to be primarily through face-to-face encounters. Matt referred to public transport, which continues to be a problem, on the street, in the home, anywhere in public spaces. So that's probably one area of distinction. In answer to your question, Will, the impacts, the consequences, they could be devastating in a number of ways. We're often familiar with the physical injuries of hates and those physical harms. Matt referred to his own experience there, and that's very commonplace, those physical injuries. But we're perhaps, as a society, perhaps more familiar with those. I think what we're less familiar with are the emotional costs of hate crime, the damage to self-esteem, to mental health, the way in which it reinforces people's sense of alienation and isolation and self-segregation. And worse still, I've worked with numerous people who've attempted to take their own life, who regularly self-harm, who rely on medication that they can't get hold of. So the emotional consequences are devastating. That isn't just for the individual. It's also that fear of retaliatory violence, that fear of constant repetitive victimization for their family members, for their children, for their partners, for their parents. So it's a cycle, Will, really, that emotional turmoil that results. And probably a final set of consequences, I think, are the community level tensions. Often hate crimes are an attack not just on the individual identity, but they're an attack on that individual's wider group. You know, it's the fact that you don't belong here. You will continue to receive this hateful abuse until you, i.e. the other, clear off. And so you can feel the consequences of an attack, even if it's not directed upon yourself, because you have that shared sense of identity, that shared sense of difference with the victim. So there are all sorts of devastating consequences that continue to be unaddressed.
Neil, you've gone down the route of filmmaking. I'm interested that that's a path that you took, and how effective have they been in delivering, you know, the outcomes that you were looking for?
Yeah, I chose to go down that route in part through a frustration that relates to the way in which we dehumanize these kinds of problems. Not deliberately, but it's so easy to look at a problem through numbers, through statistics, which can for that moment seem quite startling, quite horrific.
I'm just going to pause here for a second, sure, just to get some sense. We know the percentage increases have been huge.
Yeah.
I mean, what are the actual numbers by that you either of you would choose to kind of put in front of the audience in terms of either a million, other 2 million, other 3 million kind of X's every... I mean, what's the scale of this?
Well, it's a great question, Will, and it depends on how we look at it and what measure we find reliable. So if we look at police recorded hate incidents, which is a standard measure in England and Wales, we know that I think the latest figures show there were 145,000 hate crimes recorded by the police in England and Wales for this past year. That's approximately three times the number than there were 10 years ago. So the numbers have increased quite dramatically in terms of police recorded figures. Now, there are positives that come with that. It suggests perhaps that the police are doing a better job of recording and monitoring hate crimes. But taking that good news element to one side, I think it's quite a staggering picture in itself. But the news gets a lot worse than that. We know from research evidence, my own, from other studies, Matt's included, that the police recorded figures are the tip of the iceberg. We know that around one in four victims tend to report any of their experiences of hate crime. And so given that hate crime is a repeat experience, if only one in four people are willing to share any of those experiences with the police, then we know that that figure of 145,000 really is the tip of the iceberg. And the true scale of the problem is significantly higher. So when it comes to volume, Will, it's incredibly difficult to quantify the scale of abuse, and particularly in that digital world that Matt's been referring to, where it's even more tricky to measure the volume.
But it could be 500,000, even as high as 1,000,000, but it's a big number. Anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just want to get some sense of scale of it.
Sure. I think that's important, Will, because in terms of volume, it's incredibly worrying, and the increase worries us more, I think, as criminologists. And we've lived in years where we've seen hostility perhaps legitimized through the media, through political decisions that sometimes enable hostility and allow it to prosper. So coming back to your question about filmmaking and why it felt important, I feel the numbers in isolation perhaps don't capture enough attention, because it allows us to dehumanize these problems. These numbers allow us to believe, well, this is horrible, but it affects a certain person or a certain section of society. And we forget about the human stories that are at the heart of these problems. And that really is the essence of my research. You referred at the start to the work that we've done. We've, at the Centre for Hate Studies, we've worked with more than 2,000 victims of hate crime from all kinds of different backgrounds, walks of life, different parts of the country, who've experienced different forms of harassment, hostility, violence. But I think the unifying theme across all of these victims is a desire to want it to stop. And it cannot stop just through a criminal justice response in isolation. It can only stop if we start to understand and take ownership collectively as a society. And that's why the title of your podcast series really strikes a chord with me, The We Society. We all have a stake in this. And through filmmaking, it allows me to get those stories front and center in a way that captures the attention of everybody. We take these films into schools, colleges, universities, prisons, wherever we can, and it really does make a difference.
And academically, how are they received?
Well, actually, so I think we're at a moment in academia where we recognise the need for a balanced set of outputs. So, of course, our focus on our books, our journal articles, our conference presentations will never disappear, and rightly so. We need that academic rigour. We need to test ourselves in academic environments. But it's very important not to be part of an echo chamber. And I feel that very strongly, and I know Matt does too, that our work needs to resonate with public audiences. So identifying that balance and identifying creative methodologies as well as creative dissemination methods is really key to getting our work to make a difference.
Just a brief pause in the conversation to tell you a bit about the Academy of Social Sciences, which is the organisation behind the We Society podcast. The general election may be over, but that's only the beginning for the new government, as it has many pressing challenges to sort out. From education to the economy, every aspect of our society is crying out for fresh ideas and solutions. Social science stands ready to step up to the plate. I'm Will Hutton, the president of the Academy of Social Sciences. We're a national body for academics, practitioners, and learned societies in the social sciences. We champion the vital role of social science in our society, from education to government and business. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work, support us, or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. Matthew, I was quite intrigued, actually, that one of the better tools to get perpetrators to desist, it's actually, you know, mockery, lampooning them, humour, rather than kind of, you know, finger wagging and lecturing them. Do you want to kind of expand on that?
Well, it It helps in certain circumstances for certain types of hate. And I think what you're referring to is particularly online hate and how we engage with those that spout disinformation that's divisive, that engage in abusing folks for any aspect of their identity on social media. We're pioneering a few tools that use what's termed as counter speech. And there's a body of research that's building up that shows the effectiveness of counter speech in certain contexts, online in particular. And it's akin to, say, someone in a bar saying something racist or homophobic and someone overhearing that and then standing up to them and saying, you know, that's not acceptable here, you know, say sorry or get out. So it's something that we're not, you know, it's not alien to us. And in any decent environment, society, you'd hope that someone would stand up for that person that's being spoken ill about in that way. And we take that concept and apply it to the online arena. And it's happened organically. We actually saw a lot of it around the Brexit vote, and there was a lot of tense discussion around that, lots of mis and disinformation about immigration and so on. And there was a lot of counter speech emerging in the face of a lot of this nonsense that was being circulated online. And it seemed to be effective at changing some minds. Now, not everyone's going to be convinced by counter speech. They're certainly the incorrigibles, those ones that those individuals who are full-time haters that tend to have their whole worldview a certain way. And there's no convincing them with a bit of counter speech, a nudge online. These folks would need a lot of attention in terms of, even if it's, you know, potentially a de-radicalization program for some folks. But a lot of individuals who engage in hate speech do it for maybe a thrill-seeking reason, a retaliatory reason. They're triggered by an event, for example, like Brexit or a terror attack. They take to social media to vent a frustration that they're feeling. Their prejudice that they hold has been justified for a short period of time by an event or what a politician has said that's riled them up. And there's a lot of promise in counter speech, in actually putting them back in their place and actually educating them potentially that what they've said is actually factually incorrect, maybe sometimes if it's mis or disinformation, or indeed using humor in a way to engage some people. And we found with some forms of online hate speech, certainly with things like misogyny, that using humor can actually promote engagement. It's a way of breaking down barriers between in-groups and out-groups sometimes, and it's been seen to be somewhat effective in some cases, but not every case. And using humor in some cases, say, for example, in sort of anti-Black hate speech, may actually inflame the situation. So you've got to be very careful with the tactics that you deploy online to identify whether or not this counter speech is going to work.
You're using AI? I mean, just how does that fit into the equation?
Sure. There's a lot of anxiety about artificial intelligence right now, in terms of it exacerbating biases and prejudices. And that's fair because it's learning off human-created content. It's mining the internet for everything it can to act like a human being. And unfortunately, most of the content that it's hoovering up will include these biases that we're seeing offline as well as online.
So you want to challenge the AI algorithms?
That's right. It goes back to the point about counter speech we were talking about earlier on. Increasingly, people in this polarized online world and offline world are getting anxious about engaging in counter speech for fear of retaliation. And that's happening a lot more. We're speaking to charities, etc., and they're saying that their community members are now disengaging from social media. And, you know, Neil came off social media because he was being attacked far too much on a very deeply personal level. And people are disengaging from social media. So we're losing really important people from social media, like the eminent professor of hate in the UK, for example, if not internationally. And that's a loss because we need people like Neil on social media fighting the good fight. And with that we're seeing that this kind of disengagement, we had the idea as part of Hate Lab and its spin out, which is now a commercial venture, to automate counter speech in a way, to program AI.
Yeah, there are companies that actually kind of buy your services because they want to protect.
That's right. Yeah. Absolutely. So for example, governments, but also brands are very interested in reinforcing their brand values, speaking out against hate when someone goes on their channel to spout some vitriol, some horrible mis or divisive disinformation. And instead of, you know, to leave that information there and not engage with it is seen as being complicit. So in a sense, brands are now having to stand up against this kind of hatred on their brand channels. And they need some scientific backed evidence on what works in that context. So we can advise on what works, but we're also building artificial intelligence that will automate that for them. So what we're looking at there is scale and speed. If we can create AI that can build on the counter-speech legacy of human beings and identify these teachable moments and the movable middle, those individuals who are persuadable to come back to the right side, I should say left side maybe, and then ultimately we might see some outstanding good use of AI in this context.
Neil, I mean, this work that you're doing, I mean, it's, you know, you're the director of the Center for Hate Studies. Your films are increasingly well known, but are you yourself, you get attacked as, you know, the woke professor. Does that kind of steal your resolve, or do you think, great, the name calling means I'm hitting a nerve and it only proves the salience what I'm doing? How do you deal with that?
It's a really interesting question, Will. I think through the earlier part of my career, I took it in some ways as a bit of a badge of honour, that we were doing something that was meaningful and that matters. I used to, for instance, get letters, beautifully handwritten letters from a guy who signed off as Death Incarnate, and beautifully crafted letters, page after page after page, promising me by a very slow and painful death and all sorts of expletives associated with that. But I didn't take it so seriously. And then they started building up and building up. And then we started getting National Front stickers on the front door of my workplace. And so it was only then that I reported. That was the first time I reported, actually. And I was told that I should expect that kind of thing doing the work that I do, which wasn't the best response that you could encounter. So I took it as a badge of honour, and that continued throughout my career, and it reinforced my steely resolve, as you refer to it as. It's perhaps only the past year or so that it started to affect me a little bit more. I think I took a six-month break from X as a result of some pretty horrific trolling, the nature that Matt's described, that affects so many different people, quite personalised attacks, the emails, the letters. It became quite difficult for a time. And when it starts affecting your colleagues and your family members as well, which it has over the past year in terms of attacks on them, then it starts to become a bit difficult. So I think it affects people in different ways. The one positive with all of that, well, two positives. One, of course, it reinforces that we're doing something that matters and it should never deter us. But secondly, I think we're better now as a community of scholars and activists and policymakers of talking about this. I never talked about it in the first part of my career. And now I talk about these kinds of experiences. I encourage my researchers and early career colleagues to do the same. I know Matt's very similar. And that's really helpful. It's lovely, and it emboldens us, I think, and reminds us of the importance of the collective and not just the individual, as I said right at the start of this conversation.
And just very briefly, next steps: rural hate crime, harassment in higher education. Is that becoming increasingly salient, both those issues?
Oh, yes, without hesitation, I would say that. So I'm leading a major nationwide study on racism in rural towns and villages. Big piece of research. We report on that next year. It's a fascinating, crucial piece of research. I also start a major ESRC-funded study from January looking at harassment in UK universities. Again, we've seen recent episodes of this flare up. We've seen with the Gaza situation an increase in tensions within the student communities, but we've seen this for years across all sorts of different groups and identities within our student community. So anything we can do to support our students and to eradicate harassment, 40 universities to take this seriously is a key step. So they're two of the main research projects that I have on the go at the moment.
Come back to you, Matthew. I mean, we've not really talked about, it's tangential a bit, this trigger events, but of course one of the kind of features of the last 10 years has been, I mean, brutally the aggressive language used by the extreme right. Is that part of the story? There's a kind of increasing sense of license. There's more the kind of bandwidth with which one can kind of operate has grown much wider. So one can say more hateful things legitimately or quasi-legitimately. It's never legitimate, but quasi, what's considered to be off limits, the definition has widened and widened.
We talk about the Overton window and the shifting of the Overton window to the left or the right. What's politically possible at any one given time? And I've certainly seen that Overton window shift. You know, what is acceptable? What can I get away with? What will the public accept me saying in the context that we're currently in? And given the successive sort of, as you say, trigger events, political but also terror-related trigger events, economic trigger events, etc., that have seemed to have culminated over the last decade even. What's become politically acceptable to say, what you can get away with in public discourse now, seems to have changed quite dramatically. That Overton window has definitely shifted to the right, I'd say. And what we're seeing here is division and hate being weaponized by public speakers, be they politicians or not. But public speakers that have become quite well known for their outbursts, and I think every time something is uttered, reported on in the press, uttered in radio, on YouTube, or something like that, and there is support for it from a section of the public, these politicians get bolstered. They seem to think, well, that didn't backfire, and the next time they do it, they go a bit further, and we're seeing it at the individual level, but also at the state level. So, for example, certain countries I write about in my book, Russia, but also China, we've seen at that level books getting banned. And we were seeing books getting banned in the US too. Certain kinds of literatures that are seen as too woke, potentially. I am now a banned author in Russia, which is, I hold up as a badge, just going back to what Neil was talking about in terms of the experiences.
Congratulations, Matt.
Thank you so much for that. Initially, I was mortified, but then I'm now an LGBTQ+ terrorist, extremist, apparently, for sharing my experiences in written form. They actually bought the book and then decided to ban it afterwards, so I kept the advance. But it's not being released in Russia. But you're seeing the politics of this really being intertwined with personal experiences as well. And I think that's something that we've not seen for quite some time.
I should just give you the opportunity in 30 seconds, no longer. I mean, a complete elevator pitch, and this lift has only got 4 floors to go. So to give us the kind of top line messages of your book.
So ultimately, it tries to explain to a general audience why we hate, how we get from something like a bias or a prejudice that we all have to something like hateful violence. And it goes from evolution and psychology, sort of the pizza base of our experience and how our brains work, all the way through the various toppings that have to be added to accelerate a person from a usually law-abiding person to someone who can take to the streets and perform a hateful act. And I use my personal story as a vehicle to take a person through that sort of psychological, sociological journey. And it's the whole effort there was to try and make this accessible to the general person, as Neil said in his filmmaking. I think this kind of topic requires that personal touch that is impactful.
Neil, if this carries on uninhibited, I mean, just give us a sense of what you feel is at risk and how hopeful you are that we can address this.
What's at risk if we continue down this path? Well, I think it speaks volumes about the kind of society that we want to be, Will, really. This isn't just a problem that affects pockets of individuals or communities. It affects us all, because all of these problems spill into broader issues. So the way in which we think about our economics, our housing, our healthcare, our education, AI, all of this has knock-on effects for the way in which people encounter and experience hostile acts and behaviours. So it's really positive to see those conversations start to take place. And I have another role, Will, as you referred to earlier, as a founding director of the Institute for Policy here at Leicester. And I've been struck by the very grown-up conversations that are taken for granted within other fields, within climate change, within the context of prisons increasingly now, within the context of education. It's really lovely to see that. And it just feels like the right moment to transpose that to the field of hate studies. This isn't a criminal justice issue in isolation. This is a public health emergency. And the way in which we come together as stakeholders in society, as individuals, as practitioners, as activists, as academics, but people from different sectors as well, health, education, as well as criminal justice. If we come together, share our knowledge, share our good practice within a very strained resource environment, so much good can happen. And those conversations are starting to happen. So I feel more optimistic than I did 12 months ago, certainly. Well,
do you share that optimism, Matthew?
We know what works in reducing prejudice. In the lab, we know for the past 60, 70 years, there have been numerous social psychology studies conducted, and we know what reduces prejudice. And for example, the contact thesis itself, originally mentioned by Gordon Allport in the 1950s in The Nature of Prejudice, that key study in our field, has been conducted over 500 times in over 500 studies on over 250,000 people in over 38 countries. And the contact hypothesis, which simply suggests that when people come into contact with people that they're not familiar with from a different creed or ethnicity or sexual orientation, if they spend time with them, quality time, their prejudices melt away. It's been found to be particularly effective at reducing anti-gay prejudice, followed by physical impairment, race, mental health, and age. And ultimately what it does is contact breeds familiarity and liking, in a sense. The key is, how do you get that kind of knowledge out of the lab into a societal response? And it does take the whole system, in a way. It does take education. It does take housing. It does take health. Working together in this kind of public health approach to see the science embedded within policy in a way that's not piecemeal. It's not something like, you know, we're doing it because it will win votes or whatever. It's a genuine attempt to solve this problem. And I think, like Neil, I am more hopeful than I have been for quite some time.
That's good news. Well, Professor Matthew Williams, thank you very much. Professor Neil Chakraborty, thank you very much for a kind of very enlightening 45 minutes. It's been both the scale of this problem, the rate at which it's been increasing, what's driving it, both in terms of one individual's kind of particular psychological kind of proclivities and external stimuli, where you see the spikes, the measures that you're both taking to try to limit it, try to raise its salience, try to raise awareness, and some optimism there at the end. It's been a very important podcast, and thank you both very much for your contributions, giving up your time. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the We Society podcast. I'm Will Hutton. The episode was produced by Emily Finch and was a Whistledown production for the Academy of Social Sciences. Be sure to subscribe to the We Society on the podcast hosting platform of your choosing so you can be the first to hear new episodes, and go to acss.org.uk to learn more about the Academy of Social Sciences.